Welcome to History's Hotties, the podcast that discusses the sometimes forgotten but influential women in American history, and I am your host, Krista. This is our fourth and final part in our series on the myth of Scarlet. I have to apologize for the length of time between episodes 13 and 14. Again, I know there was a long time between 12 and 13, but it's happened again. Between Christmas and our college-age daughter coming home to visit and an awesome trip to Hawaii to visit my husband, who met us there from Korea, our family has been very busy. I have really wanted to wrap up our series on the myth of Scarlet, but I wanted to make sure I had time to really do more research first. So we have discussed the plantation mistress, the working class woman and farmer's wife, and now we move on to the women who had no illusions that their lives might be even slightly similar to Scarlet, and certainly weren't treated like the fragile females of the mystic plantation. Historians often point out that female slaves and free black women of the South faced two challenges, as slaves and as women. They were humans who were treated as less than human. They were slightly more valuable than chattel, simply because it was illegal to just outright kill a slave in most southern states. But the state of life of the slave made being a woman a whole other world for these southern women. While some slave owners allowed their slaves to have ceremonies customary to their white owners, there was little belief that slaves were really in charge of their own lives, families, and bodies. Mothers and children were separated when slaves were sold. Spouse relationships were often unobserved during sales as well. And even if the master did allow a family to stay together, it was because the master was compassionate, not because the slave-family relationship had any legal value. It is pretty well known that slaves on plantations of more than a handful of slaves were usually separated into either field slaves or house slaves, and while being a house slave may have been easier, and there were some class considerations between house and field slaves, we are discovering that often slaves preferred field work simply because of the social connection and kinship connections created in the field and in the slave quarters, while house slaves were often required to sleep right near their charges or in their work area to be available 24/7, often creating a very separate and lonely life. As we know from every study about women, community connections were very influential to women. Women worked together in groups divided by job and time to help one another with child care and caring for homes and families. Because men were often gone, women would step in to fill the void of helping a mother. So he may be gone to another plantation, or he may live in another place, or oftentimes the mother would have been sold away, so the father wouldn't have been there. In the fields, masters were pretty much gender blind, but in the slave quarters, there was a strict division of labor. Women cooked and cleaned and raised the children, often by working as a group. They wove cloth, sewed clothes, made candles, grew gardens, and did many other tasks that really resembled the colonial household. And in the slave quarters, they were the wives of their home. This was, however, not because women were considered weak, but slave women were not considered among and in their culture to be considered weak, but because it was better for the woman to be able to stay in the home after hours of work out in the field. They wanted to be near their children. Sometimes this was a welcome relief for these families, but they wanted their family ideal, to be able to live like a white family often. To other women, especially right after the Civil War, some of them were actually, however, unwilling to submit to the authority of a husband in the place of a master. So you'll see both reactions in the journals and stories of slave women. Some that really wanted to stay home to raise their children and to have their husband work, and the husband wanted that as well. And then there were others that absolutely refused to marry for whatever reason. There are numerous stories of fashions, this is kind of interesting, that white women refused to wear when newly freed women adopted them post-Civil War, and the plantation owners were particularly annoyed as the newly rejoined families tried their hardest to live on the income of the husband, depriving landowners of half of their field hands. I suppose the reaction and post-war choices of the former bonded families depended on the experience of the particular people and the particular woman. But in the fields, unless a plantation mistress stepped in, which they did sometimes, as we learned in our discussion of the wealthy class women, These women did similar work as men and were beaten the same as men, unless she happened to be pregnant. Sometimes the gangs were separated by sex, the working gangs out in the fields, but still very hard labor was done by all. Funny enough, though, if slaves were used to supervise in the fields, it was a man who was chosen, and men were also the slaves that were able to learn and hire out as a tradesman, like being a blacksmith or a carpenter. Women might be able to hire themselves out sewing or baking, and it is not surprising that women were not trained in these trades, like being a blacksmith, but neither were white women. But it does highlight the irony of the fact that slave women were women that were not allowed to learn these trades, but yet in the field she worked right next to that same man and was expected to do the same labor. There were men who tried to protect their females from beatings or some other abuse, but you can imagine how that went over for the male slave. Protecting the fragile female was not seen as a chivalrous act as it would have been from a white man, but instead, she was seen as a piece of property. So he was a piece of property interfering with the discipline of another piece of property. What is even more befuddling is that when former slave women did not work in the field and stayed at home, they were often accused of female loaferism. That was a common phrase that was used at the time, female loaferism. So now we know that even the plantation mistress was working in most instances. She was not just sitting around. But for doing the same work as the mistress, the former slave woman was criticized. Of course, the work of women and the ideal behavior of women was strongly interwoven with sexual mores and behaviors. Slaves of working class families were often even more isolated when a working class farmer was able to buy a slave because he would hire a lot of times a female to help his wife. If he already had enough help in the field, you go to this working class family, they only have one or two slaves. So you've got this female slave who is bought by this man who can finally afford someone to have his, to help his wife in the kitchen. He hires her, and now she's completely isolated. So all of these things that happen on the plantation, now she's instead, this young woman is now separated and alone from everyone else. So these women had no kinship ties to give them comfort or support of any kind. But back to I did mention in the previous section the dressing habits of slave women. According to Gail Collins, slaves took far more care in their dress when going out on a day pass or to church than their working class white counterparts. Owners would sometimes offer calico to a female slave as a reward for producing a child, and these women would use whatever they had to stiffen petticoats. The example that I saw was hominy, which is basically the starchy part of corn mixed with water, and they made hoops for their skirts out of grapevines. They would take off their shoes if they had any while walking on dusty roads and did their best to find time on the weekends to wash their family clothes. The other funny fact that I have to share is that often when white owners would tell slaves to clean up their cabins, there were those who asserted that their homes were at least as clean as their poor white neighbors. And as I shared in the podcast on the working class white woman and her living standards, this was probably true. This was very much probably true. So, back to the interwoven sexual mores and behaviors, I'm going to speak a little graphically here, so if you have any children listening, you may want to put on your headphones. Expected sexual behavior was such an integral part of the social structure in the South for the planter class, but was so different among slave and free black women. Unwed mothers were not looked down on in the slave quarters. Now, of course, they couldn't legally marry, but they often didn't make commitments and would have ceremonies. But while often slave families tried to live a life somewhat representative of the normal middle class ideal, with a father, mother, and children, they were well aware that this was a wish and not always possible, and they allowed for what would be considered inappropriate behavior in the white world. In addition, adultery was highly frowned upon among slaves. They saw their masters doing this, but this was really not acceptable behavior in the slave quarters. Slaves often separated the good masters from the bad masters by their attitude towards slave marriage. And surprisingly enough, there were courtship rituals that were often isolated to the different slave groupings, but generally for no other reason than proximity. It would be near impossible for a man to, say, court a woman who did not live and work near him, though it did happen even between plantations. However, great pains were taken to attempt monogamy. This was often with heartbreaking results. You would have a young man who was courting a young woman, and if he were coming from a different place or wanted to have a quote unquote, marriage with her, he would have to get the permission of her master. He would have to get the permission of her father. He would often have to get the permission of the overseer, and he would have to get the permission from her mother. So it was really difficult for a young man to court a young woman. And so all this time has been taken to develop this relationship. They frown upon adultery. They're living, wanting to live in a monogamous relationship. But that wasn't always possible. And there were a few reasons for that. One was eugenics. It was practiced regularly by masters who might pair up two slaves he believed would produce strong workers. One particular story I found was a woman named Rose Williams, who was relieved to be bought from the auction block by the same man as her parents, having no idea that he intended to match her up with another slave named Rufus because he thought that they would have what she called portly children together. When the master first sent them to live in a cabin together, Rose spent the first couple of nights fending off Rufus with a fire poker until her master called her to him and told her that the only reason he bought her was to breed, not for sympathy for a family that wanted to stay together. And he expected her to marry and Rufus and have children. The Civil War began just a few years later, and when Rose was a free woman, her reaction to what her master had done to her was to refuse to ever marry again. Like I said before, you see after the Civil War different reactions. Some of the slave families used this as an opportunity to stay together where they might have been sold and separated previously, and others said, I will never submit to anything resembling what my white master told me I had to do. I love the statement that Rose made when she said that the good Lord would have to rely on other women to replenish the earth. When slave women did have children, and she was regularly pregnant, a slave woman, she averaged about 13 pregnancies over the span of her childbearing years. It was really tough for her to care for her children and worry about her other duties. Her children were far more likely to die than the white children on the same plantation from poor care and nutrition during pregnancy and in early childhood, and heavy labor during the child's early years. Women would have to work before and after their hours of actual work on the plantation, doing all the tasks necessary to keep their own family running, because their husband, their quote unquote husband, had his tasks to do as well. In addition, one of though the other interesting facts is that a slave woman was actually less likely to die in actual childbirth. And it's believed that that's because they didn't wear corsets and they actually got exercise during the day. Even though they were overworked, they weren't sitting, they weren't confined to the bed. They weren't, in that era, women were entered into confinement about a month before their actual baby was born, and they might lay in bed that whole time, which is really, as we know now, not conducive to a good and healthy labor. So the pregnant woman might have a miscarriage more often, or the child might die earlier, but actually dying in childbirth, a slave woman was less likely to die in childbirth than a white woman. So, as we talked about in our discussion of the plantation mistress, in an attempt to keep their husbands and sons away from the female slaves, white women would try to instruct the bondswomen in moral and spiritual values regarding sexual behavior, and often blame the female slave when the woman was forced to have sex with a white man. There were lectures about how to act like a lady, but slave women were given no respect as a female in a culture that carefully cultivated this ideal of womanhood. And I like to go back to the story of Harriet Jacobs and Dr. Flint. Mrs. Flint repeatedly lectured and cajoled Harriet to behave herself, knowing that Dr. Flint was pressuring Harriet to become his mistress. And Harriet's plan to defend herself, not only from the good doctor, but also from the wrath of Mrs. Flint, was to become the mistress of a white lawmaker and businessman living in the same town. The worst story of an angry wife was told by an ex-slave who said that the mistress actually, and this is horrible, but if we don't study at all, what are we really learning? Actually cut the head off a baby her husband had fathered by one of his slaves. And that was a fact noted in Gail Collins' book that I've referenced before, Dolls, Drudges, and Helpmates. A woman who refused advances of a white man that was not actually beaten or raped was always in danger of being sold off from her husband and children, or if she was young, her parents and siblings. But if she gave in, she might even be able to gain some protection for her husband and children. However, often when the master was finished with her, as Harriet Jacobs talked about in her autobiography, he would often sell her to remove her from his and his wife's sight if he did not have a large enough plantation to like move her out to the fields to be out of sight, out of mind. So you had, it was like a calculated risk. Do you refuse him and possibly be beaten? Well, you probably, determine, based on the history of your master, which one he was likely to do, or if he would not beat or rape you, would he sell you? If you did give in, would he maybe refrain from beating your children? These women would have to take these calculated risks. There were even stories of a master showing up at the slave cabin door and kicking the husband out of the house while he had sex with the wife. As you can imagine, living like this made the slave men perpetually angry at the master. And sometimes created anger at the wife, though she really had no control over the encounter. In addition, husbands sometimes scorned the children born to the wife by the master because they were a constant reminder of the other man who had sexual rights to his wife. One other story that is actually a little more upbeat than most of the tales we usually hear was about a kitchen slave in Virginia named Suki, whose master attempted to rape her while she was making soap. Suki punched him and then shoved him so he fell butt first into the soap that she was making. He got up and ran away, but was too afraid to yell because he didn't want his wife to find out what had happened. And I'm sure he was hurting because to make soap, the pot would have been boiling. And the person recounting the story tells us that the master was burned pretty badly. The estimate of slave children that were partially white was born was somewhere between 10 and 20%, which only gives us a small window, glimpse into how many slave women were subjected to sexual advances by their masters. I believe the figure I quoted in part two of the series was that about 57% of masters, used their female slaves for sexual purposes at some point. There were, of course, always the stories of the master who seemed to actually love his conquest. There was Thomas Foster, a Mississippi planter who was married and had an affair with his slave, Susie. His wife tried to sell her, but he took Susie away to live with her, leaving his wife and children, and you can imagine how that went over with the other good citizens of his town. Living openly with a slave mistress could really cost a man public opinion, and did to some men like Senator Richard Johnson of Kentucky, who had two daughters with a slave that he was rumored to take out in public as if they were white, which was reportedly the reason the Southern delegates were unwilling to ratify his selection as the nominee for vice president. So the cult of Southern womanhood, or the Southern woman who not only met the standard of mother, nurturer, wife, helpmate, and moral center, as well as household manager and jewel on her husband's arm, which was the myth for the planter's wife, and sometimes strived for and sometimes ignored by the working class, was completely unattainable to the slave or free black woman of the South. She might try to be the caregiver for her family, but was reminded daily that she was not considered a woman in the ordinary sense. But their wiles as females would certainly serve the purpose of men who owned and controlled them. You are a woman who is not considered a woman. You have no rights, but you are not protected as the weaker sex by society. You have no rights, but you are blamed for the crimes committed against you. Certainly not the ideal of womanhood, and certainly not the life of Scarlet, or even Scarlet's mammy. She raised the children and worked in the homes and fields of this nation, suffering greatly as both a woman and a slave. She should be remembered for her suffering, as well as her contributions to her whole society and to history. So that's our episode for today. I know it was short, but I think, we all know a lot about slave life. I just thought that these were a few points that needed to be highlighted. So if you have any questions, comments, or snide remarks, all of which we accept, please contact us at historieshotties@yahoo.com. That's historieshotties@yahoo.com. So until next time.